Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A Chinese company called Huawei. The House Intelligence Committee says we should be very, very afraid. How to lower gas prices fast. Jerry Brown is trying. And you think a private college education is pricey now? Just wait. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcast.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, October 8th. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, who's on his way to WGBH in Boston for our third special election show. Most of us had probably never heard of a company called Huawei Technologies until we read the news this morning. But a U.S. congressional committee has been investigating the Chinese telecommunications giant for a year now. And today, the committee said the company may be guilty of bribery and violating American immigration laws. It also said American companies and the U.S. government should not do business with Huawei and a smaller Chinese company, ZTE, because they pose threats to U.S. national security. Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz begins our coverage.
The allegations strengthen suspicions in the U.S. that Huawei is an agent of the Chinese military and would use U.S. market access for espionage and network attacks. David Wolf is president of the Beijing-based Wolf Group Asia, a tech consultancy firm. He's received funding from a Huawei-backed grant for a past book project. He says if Huawei were allowed to do more business in the U.S., it would not operate on behalf of China's government.
I would say that Huawei, given that 70% of its business is outside of the PRC, would sooner give up its business in China, indeed sooner give up its domiciling in China, than it would to cave into a request like this from the government.
Huawei is the world's second largest network equipment seller, operating in nearly 150 markets worldwide. Bill Bishop, a digital media entrepreneur in Beijing, says the U.S. government's case against Huawei is questionable.
Our government certainly, you know, claims it's doing it for national security reasons, but I think that we can probably be pretty confident that the U.S. government is maybe the best at exploiting telecommunications networks. So if anyone's going to know how to do this, it's probably the U.S. government.
In other words, says Bishop, we can do it, so why wouldn't they?
Part of it is from the U.S. government perspective is saying, trust us. Part of it from Huawei's perspective is saying, trust us. And if you're in Washington, you know, which side are you going to trust more?
Whatever the outcome, says Bishop, this may hurt the prospects of U.S. companies like Cisco in China, which already make network equipment and chips there. Then again, maybe not. Cisco's been sued for helping China's government censor the internet. The company denies the claims. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
So a lot of skepticism in China about the allegations against Huawei. On Capitol Hill, a different story. Congressman Mike Rogers is a Republican from Michigan. He chairs the House Intelligence Committee, which is calling for more investigations into Huawei. Rogers has called the Chinese company a serious threat. He joins us now. Congressman Rogers, thanks for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Congressman, what specifically are you worried would happen? You know, military secrets would be spilled, spying on personal conversations in the United States. Give me a specific risk.
Everything from personal medical records to personal financial data to companies' intellectual property is ripe for stealing. And unfortunately, we know today, and this is where we started the investigation, that the nation state of China has invested billions in their military and intelligence services specifically to steal intellectual property, to take that information back, repurpose it, and use it to artificially compete against those companies. All of that data is even more exposed and more at risk if they control the networks that those data packets fly across here in the United States.
Huawei has already won sizable contracts in places like Britain and in emerging markets. What do we know that they don't? I mean, they seem comfortable with this.
Well, Great Britain now has come back and said, well, in order for them to continue to operate here, we have to have a third-party validation system that they're trying to create today in order to try to protect the security of those networks. That's really unprecedented. So to say that they don't have a problem with it really isn't accurate. They have a huge problem with it now. They approved it and now are trying to figure out how to mitigate their threat to what they know is to their networks and the information on their networks.
Congressman, what is this going to do to our already sort of fragile trade relationship with China? We already have tensions over solar panels, anti-dumping charges. Are you worried about where this is going to lead?
You know, China for years has been conducting these huge operations on cyber espionage that really is working to steal the next generation of economic prosperity from Americans. Some believe over trillions of dollars have been stolen by China. And so you can't just turn a blind eye to that and expect any change in behavior. And this report, I think, is a very clear indication that we just won't put up with that.
So what happens next, logistically? Your committee has come out with this recommendation. Now what?
Well, two things. First, I think it sends a very clear message to American businesses. They shouldn't really rely on Huawei and ZTE as good vendors that they can have faith and confidence that personal information and national security issues won't be at stake. So don't use them. Find other vendors. And secondly, we have to make sure that the criminal allegations that are made by current and former Huawei employees and others are taken care of and thoroughly investigated. And we hope to a more transparent place.
Congressman Rogers, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
A prediction about China's economy put a damper on stocks today. Details when we do the numbers. Another kind of investigation going on in this country, this one, though, into a deadly outbreak of fungal meningitis. Health officials say more than 90 people in the U.S. have contracted the rare disease, and the outbreak continues to spread. So far, at least 8 people have died. The outbreak's been linked to an injectable steroid. It was made by a company called the New England Compounding Center in Framingham, Massachusetts. And it's what's known in the business as a compounding pharmacy. But as Marketplace's David Gura reports, these kind of pharmacies are not subject to the same regulations as drug manufacturers.
A compounding pharmacy does what all pharmacies used to do. It makes custom medicines, ointments, tablets, and yes, injectable drugs. James Karboski is a pharmacy professor at the University of Texas.
In the beginning, all there was compounding.
But the margins on prescription drugs are thin, so chain pharmacies have made up for that by selling more than medicine. But small pharmacies can't do that, so they've turned to compounding. David Creeling teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Pharmacy.
With compounding, since they're individualized and unique, the provider has a lot more latitude to establish and specify the price.
And that price is often lower than major drug makers, which appeals to doctors and clinics. Today, there are more than 7,500 compounding pharmacies. James Karboski at Texas says some of them are like miniature manufacturers, but they're not technically manufacturers.
The difference between compounding and manufacturing has always been a bit of a battle between, you know, the Food and Drug Administration and pharmacy organizations.
Large-scale drug companies are regulated by the FDA, but compounding pharmacies are not. They're regulated at the state level. Frank Palumbo heads the University of Maryland's Center on Drugs and Public Policy. He says there's a lot we don't know about the compounding pharmacy linked to the meningitis outbreak.
But typically, a pharmacy is supposed to have a prescription for basically everything it dispenses to a patient.
And Palumbo says it's hard to imagine the New England Compounding Center had a prescription for each of the steroids it shipped across the country, more than 17,000 doses. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, daredevil Felix Baumgartner will attempt to break a world skydiving record. Fearless Felix will ascend in a helium balloon to the stratosphere above Roswell, New Mexico. Then he'll jump from 23 miles above the Earth, 3 miles higher than the current record. Now, if that sounds insanely dangerous, well, it is. And the entire event is brought to you by Red Bull. The energy drink is sponsoring Baumgartner's jump and has created a whole marketing campaign around it. Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
If all goes according to plan, Felix Baumgartner will freefall for 5 minutes and exceed the speed of sound. Here on Earth, Red Bull will live stream the jump on its website. As a marketing event goes, it's risky, says Lewis Foreman, CEO of Inventus.
Most mainstream brands wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. Red Bull's a great fit. It's really what their consumer enjoys seeing. It's kind of that live-on-the-edge lifestyle.
And because Red Bull is one of the only major brands that will touch these events, it can make a positive impact that will also resonate with its consumer, says marketing expert Deborah Kay.
So when you have a company the size of Red Bull, they can actually fund better equipment. They can actually help people to advance extreme sports.
Red Bull says data from this free fall will be used for astronauts and future space tourists. But the downside is real. Stunt jumpers have died at Red Bull events. Injury and risk are part of extreme sports, and Red Bull consumers know that, says branding consultant Rob Frankel.
But at least it will have been in the name of trying something, bleeding edge adventure, which is still consistent with the Red Bull brand.
No word on how much Red Bull has paid to make Baumgartner's skydive happen, but Frankel says the publicity they're getting is worth a lot.
Chances are for every dollar that they spend, they're probably getting at least 10 times, if not more, that kind of media.
As bang for the buck goes, that is pretty extreme. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, why does a private college cost $50,000 a year?
We rely on heavily skilled, very well educated staff and faculty to provide a first-rate education.
But first, let's do the numbers. On the eve of the third quarter earnings season, Wall Street was in the doldrums. Blame European debt, blame China's slowdown, and the expectation that company reports this quarter are going to be down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 0.2%, 26 points, to close at 13,583. The NASDAQ dropped 0.75%, that's 23 points, to end at 3,112. The S&P 500 lost 0.3%, or 5 points, to close at 1,455. European markets fell. Britain's FTSE lost 0.5%, France's CAC 40 and Germany's DAX both dropped almost 1.5%. Tokyo's Nikkei Index added nearly 0.5%, and the U.S. bond market was closed for the Columbus Day holiday. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner, in for Kai Ryssdal. Grinnell is a very small liberal arts college in Iowa with a very big endowment, roughly $1.5 billion. It's one of the wealthiest schools in the country, thanks in part to investment guidance from Warren Buffett, a former trustee. But even Grinnell is weighing cutbacks to the financial aid it gives to its students, joining a debate already underway at many elite private colleges. Grinnell's president, Renard Kington, joins us now. Dr. Kington, welcome to the program.
My pleasure to be here.
So let's start with a really simple question. What does it cost to attend Grinnell College? Tuition, board, the whole thing?
The total comprehensive fee, which is a term that includes everything, is about $50,000.
$50,000?
Yes.
Now, as I understand it, Grinnell's policy for many years has been to ignore students' financial needs when deciding whether to admit a student or not. You have said that that policy is not sustainable. Why not?
Well, it depends upon what your individual school's resources are. At Grinnell, we have had a pretty generous financial aid policy so that we've met students' needs pretty fairly. In fact, we have one of the lowest average debt burden for students graduating. If we don't figure out a way to diversify our revenue stream, we will end up having to spend more and more money on aid, and at some point that begins to erode our ability to provide a first-rate education.
Why not just lower tuition across the board instead of offering such generous aid?
Well, that's a good question. And we have a number of students, not a large number. We have students who are very wealthy. And in my opinion, and opinion of many people, the students whose family have the resources should pay as close to the cost as they possibly can pay. Right now, even though we have a total fee that's about $50,000, our average cost per student is $56,000 or more. What it ends up being, in essence, is sort of a sliding scale of price based on financial resources.
I have been dying to ask a college president this question. You just said $60,000. Even for families that can afford that, why does it cost that much?
Another good question. The short answer is it costs that much because we rely on heavily skilled, very well educated staff and faculty to provide a first-rate education. And as long as the salaries of very highly educated individuals increase at a rate faster than society as a whole, we're going to have a cost structure that goes up faster. In some ways, it's a reflection of the success of translating knowledge into jobs for people.
What I'm sure this is the debate going on at Grinnell right now. If you do back away from a need-blind admissions policy, what's the campus going to look like? What does it mean for diversity?
Well, first of all, I've said before that I think it's unlikely that we will, highly unlikely that we will end need blind. But what we will do is we're going to have a community discussion about it, and we're going to figure out a way to pay for it.
So how diverse is Grinnell right now?
Grinnell is actually a fairly diverse institution. We have about 24-25% of our students are domestic students of color. We have between 12-15% international students. So we have an extraordinarily diverse institution drawing upon students from every state and 50-plus countries.
When you say figure out a way to pay for it, name me one, you know, what might be one thing you could do that you could describe to us right now?
Well, for example, we may choose to accept a few more international students who can pay the full amount in an effort to balance our revenue stream.
So I'm just curious, in 10 years, what do you think it'll cost to attend a college like Grinnell?
It will continue to cost a lot.
Well, a lot meaning?
I don't know what the number will be. It'll be more than what it costs now, unless the economy fundamentally restructures itself so that we no longer are giving large returns to people who are highly educated. And that's unlikely to happen.
Okay. We're going to have to end it there. Reynard Kington is the president of Grinnell College in Grinnell, Iowa. Dr. Kington, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
And our conversation with Dr. Kington is part of a series of conversations with college presidents. You can check them out at marketplace.org. High gas prices are a fact of life, if, like me, you live in California. But I admit I did do a double take this weekend when I drove past my neighborhood gas station here, $4.61 for a gallon of regular unleaded. Now, in some parts of the state, it was even higher. But you won't hear much about California's troubles on the campaign trail, because like so much about California, our gas prices are, well, special. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Trout reports.
Stephen Shork is an oil trader in Pennsylvania. What's he think when he looks across the map to California and our crazy gas prices from his East Coast perch?
You get what you deserve.
Ouch. But he says that lovingly. California has the toughest environmental standards in the nation. It demands a special gas blend to meet them, so all our fuel is refined in-state. And we don't have any major pipelines to bring us more in a pinch.
From an oil infrastructure standpoint, you guys are an island.
An island with one major refinery down, the Chevron fire this summer, and two more with hiccups in recent weeks. You might think refineries in other states would take advantage, whip up some of that special California gas and truck it in. But the prices aren't quite high enough for all that trouble. And now they're not likely to get there. Over the weekend, Governor Jerry Brown relaxed the state's golden standards.
He just signed his name, and gasoline supplies in California probably just rose 10% now because gasoline that wasn't allowed to be sold can now be sold.
Why not make that automatic, says Greg Laskowski at gasbuddy.com.
There should be some thresholds that would say when wholesale prices of gasoline exceed, you know, this dollar level, we waive these requirements.
Because even as prices level off after this spike, oil refineries in California are still at the edge, in danger of falling behind. And he says California voters are unlikely to greenlight any new refineries, some of the worst polluters around, anytime soon. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
You know those companies that hit you over the head with all their eco-friendly, planet-saving promises? Buy our coffee, save the rainforest, that kind of thing? Well, the newest breed of these social enterprises are easing up on the moralizing, to customers anyway. Instead, the do-gooding is aimed at investors. Alex Goldmark reports.
At the Whole Foods in Manhattan, Drew Pham is considering a new brand of tea on the shelf. It's called Runa. It comes from a special guayusa leaf from the Amazon jungle in Ecuador. If he buys a bottle, some of the money goes to social programs for indigenous family farmers.
Now I know this thing about this tea. Am I going to buy it because it's cool? Because social awareness is cool? Or am I going to buy it because I feel bad?
He bought a bottle because he heard it was sweet. And that's how Runa's 25-year-old co-founder, Tyler Gage, wants it. Gage built his business plan to turn over part ownership to farmers and to raise their tiny incomes. But he's not banking on a marketing edge from the moral high ground.
Recently, we've seen that even telling that story about farmers or social innovation actually limits our ability to sell product in a certain way.
Mainstream store owners tend to think he's selling an inferior product if his sales pitch sounds like a grant application.
The idea of, you know, hybrid organizations and social innovation and small farmer cooperative development, pretty small market.
But those confusing buzzwords are still crucial to business success. That's how Runa lined up key investors. One especially unusual investor in particular, the Socialist Government of Ecuador.
Mi nombre es Jaime Cases.
My name is Jaime Cases, director of the program CRE Ecuador in the Ministry of Production.
Jaime Calle's program invested $500,000 in Runa. That's about 5% of the company's net worth. Eventually, the government will sell its stake to the farmers. It's kind of weird to think that the government of Ecuador is financing a Brooklyn startup business.
You're like the first socialist venture capitalist government person I've ever met.
No. It's not important. It's communists, it's socialists, or it's capitalists. The final objective is development of the people.
People like Ecuadorian farmer Mauricio Grife. He's pretty fired up about selling his tea leaves to Runa. And he says he'll buy shares as soon as he can.
I hope this initiative lasts forever. Lasts and brings more support for us.
On his farm in northeast Ecuador, Grife is harvesting his guayusa plants for the first time. Until now, he's just used it to make his morning tea. But he wants to transform his breakfast habit into a business proposition. So he's planting new bushes. Grife's family of five earns about $1,200 a year, selling a mix of citrus fruits, cocoa, and banana. Selling guayusa to Runa could increase his income by 10 or maybe 20%. That's assuming the tea catches on in the U.S. with people like, well, people like me.
I have a bottle of Runa in front of me. Traditional guayusa tea. Runa. Focused energy. 50 calories per bottle. Tastes like tea. I mean, pretty sweet.
In my kitchen in New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace. And I'll put the rest in the fridge for later.
On Friday, we got some new jobs numbers from the government, and it was a pleasant surprise to hear that the unemployment number had dropped to 7.8%. But that's a faceless number, after all. We want to know how the job hunt is going for you. We asked that question on Facebook, and here's what you told us.
Harder. There are just too many people out there looking, and ads get so many email responses that the chances of my resume even being seen are slim.
For me, the search is the same. I have retained employment, but I have not had much luck with advancement, and my wage seems static.
September has been a good month for my network. Four people all found good, high-paying jobs in the IT sector in California.
I can't find qualified employees. I'm searching for a financial services sales rep, and it's frustrating.
So how's your job hunt going? Just go to our Facebook page or Marketplace.org and hit contact.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, Coca-Cola, Dr. Pepper, and Pepsi have agreed to post calories at the soda machine. The soft drink companies will roll out special vending machines next year that display the number of calories in their sodas right on the front. The latest figures show Americans on average drink over 700 8-ounce servings of carbonated soda every year. So quick calculation here, about 100 calories in 8 ounces of Coke. Let's see, that's 700 of those per year. That's 70,000 calories per year, soda lovers. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow is off 26.5 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ lost 24 points, 0.7%. And the S&P 500 ended the day down 5 points, 0.4%. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Joel Patterson, and Jolie Podokas. I'm Sarah Gardner. Hope to see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.